You don't have to pull back the layers very far to see the economic realities of the past couple of days. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Monday, today, the first day of June. Good as always to have you along, everybody. You know, the thing about this story, the protests of the past three, 4 days, is that what's happening right now, or what happened last night, or what might happen tonight, is better covered elsewhere. This, to our minds, is a systemic story of this economy, which is where our coverage is going to go. And we go first today, and mostly throughout the program, actually, to the future, specifically to begin what that future holds for the hundreds of businesses in dozens of cities that have been vandalized or looted or damaged the past couple of days. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore gets us going with this reminder that those businesses and the communities they're in are going to take years to heal.
Anthony's Pipe and Cigar Lounge is on West Lake Street in Minneapolis. Tom Harlan runs it. He's been doing business in the area for 35 years.
They broke all my cabinets. Everything was shattered. They broke my humidor. They broke into the office. They broke my safe. They blew up one of my security cameras. They even took the plywood off the barber shop across the street and broke the glass and went in there.
He says the whole area is boarded up and sprinkled with graffiti now.
Last night I was just shaking. I was out on my patio and trying to drink a beer, and I was just, you know, trying to gather my thoughts and seeing how I can regroup.
In Santa Monica, Jane Walker manages a sweater store called Texture. Her store was boarded up and survived unscathed, but other businesses near her did not.
Here you are coming back from COVID. And now with this, to recuperate from this, it's going to be a very long haul.
History might agree.
We took a look at the Rodney King riots, which occurred back in 1992.
Victor Matheson is professor of economics at the College of the Holy Cross.
Economic activity in the areas affected didn't return for at least 10 years.
At least not to previous levels. He says those riots cost almost $5 billion worth of economic activity measured in sales over 10 years.
If people don't feel safe where their businesses are, then they don't feel a need to rebuild.
Matheson and his colleagues, including Rob Bauman at Holy Cross, compared the economic recovery from the LA riots with the recovery from Hurricane Andrew in Miami, which happened the same year.
Miami recovered a heck of a lot faster.
Investors and businesses felt more comfortable returning to Miami. Another reason comes down to how the government responded.
The reaction of the federal government was a lot more swifter, and they spent a lot more money in the case of Miami.
People rebuild from hurricanes and can prepare for them, he says. Social problems seem a lot harder for the country to grapple with. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
So that's where we're going to go next. That last bit Sabri was talking about, the intersection of social problems and economic disadvantage and what can be done. What can government do? Because we've tried this before, the government has. We've gotten Kimberly Johnson on the phone. She is a professor of social and cultural analysis at New York University. Dr. Johnson, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So as I said in that introduction, there will be calls for and need for investment in some of these cities that have been damaged. The American government has tried this before, right? Give me the highlights, would you?
Sure. I mean, I think there's been many decades of investment in urban areas, ranging from, say, the 1950s and 1960s, which really focused on direct investment in people and places, so direct subsidies, to kind of the 1970s, particularly in the 1980s and 1990s, where we shifted away from direct spending to indirect spending like tax expenditures and tax credits. So that's where we are right now, is that much of our sort of investment in poor areas is via these indirect mechanisms of tax credits.
Right. And those are the empowerment zones, they were called in the Clinton administration, the opportunity zones in the 2017 tax bill. Here's the question, though. Does what we're doing now, these tax incentives, does it work?
It's very mixed. I think that to the extent that they can work, they are places where there's a lot of close collaboration between investors, local governments, community groups that really are focused on what works best for a particular community. Where it doesn't necessarily work is where something is built on the assumption that if we build it, people or businesses will come, and then that doesn't quite happen.
Yeah, Field of Dreams was a great movie, but maybe not so much in real life. Let me ask you this, though. If the results are mixed and that's widely known, why do we keep doing this? Why don't we try another way? And what would that way be that might be better?
I think we do this largely because of inertia. Other policy people call them zombie policies. They are politically attractive to both Democrats and Republicans. It also doesn't require a lot of upfront government money, which is key. So it's not that an actual bureaucrat or government official is pocketing money. It could be that, you know, a business took the money and then later we find out 5 years later, oh, they didn't really do what they were supposed to do with it. So I think there's a lot of ways in which these programs are attractive to politicians because they can kind of kick any potential problems or costs kind of down the road.
So what's your gut telling you, Professor Johnson? I mean, this is a series of protests and actions by people on the ground that we haven't seen in 50 years.
Absolutely.
Does your gut tell you it might be different or no?
I think that, you know, it's this 1-2 punch. The shutdown really revealed, I think, the vulnerability that many families found themselves in. I think the statistic came out last year that many American families had about $400 cash on hand. And if you live in a place like New York City or San Francisco, that $400 was like a week's worth of rent. And so I think one of the issues looking forward is that people have to feel that they're safe, that they have a future, that they have hope. And I think having these incidents with the police on top of economic and I think sort of real emotional distress of what we've been going through. I mean, this has been a hard month or two for many people. And then it's this. It's kind of the last straw in some ways.
Kimberly Johnson is a professor of social and cultural analysis at New York University. She does urban politics, as I said. Professor Johnson, thanks for your time, ma'am. I appreciate it.
Great. Thank you.
This is one of those days, and I know there have been a lot of them past 8-10 weeks or so. It's one of those days where you look at the world, and then you look at the stock market, and you go, no, come on. Really? Details, numbers, when we get there. There are a couple of economic realities that come to mind when watching and listening to these protests. One is that the pandemic and the lockdown have hit state and local tax revenues really hard. Another is that police departments, at least in the cities that are seeing most of the protesting, seem to be pretty well supplied and equipped. And that is drawing attention to city budgets and calls for police funding reform. Marketplace's Mariel Segarra is on that one.
In a lot of cities, policing eats up a big chunk of the general fund. In LA's latest budget proposal, it's 54%. In Minneapolis, it's about 36%. And now, with cities forced to make big spending cuts...
In many cities, the only budget item that is not facing massive cuts is the police budgets.
Andrea Ritchie researches the criminal justice system at Barnard College.
We're literally in the middle of the biggest economic crisis and the highest levels of unemployment of our generation. We're in a pandemic without universal affordable health care.
The argument is that those things should be the priority and not policing. Advocates also argue that because the bulk of a police department's budget goes towards salaries, if you cut budgets, you'll have fewer patrol officers and fewer instances of police brutality. Kumar Rao is with the Center for Popular Democracy.
When you have more and more police officers in a community, you know, research has shown it leads to more and more sort of conflict and interaction.
But this is obviously an incredibly complicated topic. Simone Weichselbaum at the Marshall Project has reported on policing for more than 15 years. She's looked at what happened in different cities that cut their police budgets, like Memphis, which saw budget cuts and layoffs after the 2008 recession.
What happened? They spent millions and millions of dollars on police overtime. And research shows that's a recipe for disaster because you have cops who are overworked, frustrated, angry, and that's just a powder keg waiting to explode.
Also, several people I talked to today said that training is one of the first things police departments would probably stop paying for. I'm Mariel Segarra for Marketplace.
Let me take a minute here and commend to your attention an interview from the Marketplace Morning Report today that complements Mariel's story pretty nicely. David Brancaccio, the host of that program, of course, with Marc Morial, the president of the National Urban League, also the former mayor of New Orleans, talking about police and police reform. I recommend it. If you missed it on the air, of course, there's a podcast. With a nod to the fact that the news fire hose is going full blast right now, we are nonetheless obliged to tell you that there is new trouble in the U.S.-China trade relationship. Bloomberg reports China has stopped buying some American agricultural products after President Trump criticized Beijing over its treatment of Hong Kong last week. That, of course, bodes ill for the Phase 1 trade deal, which took 2 long years to negotiate. So we got Gretchen Blau on the phone. She is a customs broker at Logistics Plus in Erie, PA.
Everything is still in effect. Our importers are still paying that extra 301 tariff, the 232 steel and aluminum tariff, and then the solar panel tariff. But there have been a lot of exclusions granted in the past several months, most notably with the personal protective equipment. We have one customer in particular that sells cleaning equipment, that produces cleaning equipment, and they get a lot of their parts supplied from China and Europe and whatnot. So their business was actually ramping up here in the U.S. because everyone has been cleaning everything very deeply. So, you know, we've seen a lot of slowdowns, but that's one case where I think that things are increasing. Anything that has to do with cleaning or the PPE supplies. We've been checking in with our customers to see how we can help. You know, just as it was letting up in Asia and the supplies were now available for our importing customers, then the production slowed down here. So now, you know, warehousing is something that we have to consider for those parts. So our ops team has been very busy, you know, looking at alternatives for how to move stuff, how to store stuff, rerouting things, that type of thing. So I have a 12-year-old son, and he basically asked me, well, why are you an essential worker? Because, you know, you see the doctors and the nurses and the first responders that are true heroes in all of this. And he's basically thinking, well, you sit in an office all day, and what exactly do you do that's so essential? So I explained to him that I was part of the supply chain, and one important thing I was doing was helping the doctors and the nurses and whatnot have those supplies that they need to protect themselves and import those supplies, and that's why I was an essential worker.
Gretchen Blau, customs broker and essential worker at Logistics Plus in Erie, Pennsylvania. Coming up,
we are working hard to absorb what is happening in the full sense of that word throughout the U.S. economy right now.
We all are. We all are. But first, let's do the numbers. All right, here you go on a Monday. The Dow Industrial's up 91 points today, 0.3%, 25,475. The NASDAQ up 62 points, about 0.6%, 95.52. The S&P 500 picked up 11. That is 0.3%, ended things at 3,055. The Zoom boom during lockdown as traders excited in advance of the video conferencing software company releasing its quarterly results tomorrow. Shares in Zoom picked up 13.7%. That company now worth more than $50 billion. Bonds fell. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose to 0.66%. You're listening to Marketplace.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Gusto. Look. Payday's awesome, but running payroll, calculating taxes and deductions, staying compliant, that's not easy. Unless, of course, you have Gusto. Gusto is a simple online payroll and benefits tool built for small businesses like yours. Gusto gets your team paid while automatically filing your payroll taxes. Plus, you can offer benefits like 401k, health insurance, and workers' comp. Just for listening today, you also get 3 months free. Go to gusto.com/marketplace. That's gusto.com/marketplace.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. No matter where you are in this country, some of the images you saw on the news or on social media this weekend probably came from Los Angeles. Windows shattered on Rodeo Drive. The phrase, "I can't breathe," spray painted on a building in one of this city's high-end malls. The National Guard out in front of City Hall. For construction worker Rocio Montano, she is one of the 10 people we started following in our series, The United States of Work. For her, these are images of the place that she calls home and of the city that she is helping to build. Here's a dispatch she sent us this morning.
So today is Monday, and I am not going to work. The job was closed today for some cleaning due to COVID that was supposed to be done over the weekend, but due to the curfew in downtown LA, it was pushed to today during working hours. It was nice to get a little to sleep in a little bit, but on Friday, I actually had a friend message me and ask me if I was okay, if it was near my area. I wasn't really aware of how big it had gotten, and then that's when I started looking more into it, and I saw videos and people posting stuff, and the streets kind of vandalized, and a lot of the businesses boarded up. And I do expect to see the aftermath of all of that.
There are, the past couple of days, a whole lot of people being arrested. And getting those people out of jail has given a big boost to bail reform. Marketplace Jasmine Garz has that story.
The bail system disproportionately affects low-income people and people of color, says Professor Joshua Page from the University of Minnesota.
People that don't have the resources typically can't afford to get out of bail, or they work with a bail bond company and end up losing hundreds and sometimes thousands of dollars.
There have been cases of people unable to pay, stuck in jail for weeks and months before a court date. For years, organizations like the Minnesota Freedom Fund have worked to bail them out. Right now, they're focusing a lot on the hundreds of activists being arrested nationwide. Steve Boland is with the Minnesota Freedom Fund.
It's younger people. It's more people of color who are directly impacted by police violence, by these systems in the first place, that are showing up in the street, disproportionately, probably the ones getting arrested and probably the ones that will be assigned bail rather than just released.
The fund has exceeded $20 million in donations in the last week or so. This activism has its critics. One of the states that has eliminated cash bail for minor offenses is New York. The NYPD police commissioner recently said that's led to an increase in some crimes. And some wonder, when you donate to a fund, who exactly are you bailing out? Robin Steinberg of the nonprofit The Bail Project says it's a moot point. Serious offenders might not even be eligible for bail, or it might be too high. As for misdemeanors,
the only thing that stands between freedom and being locked in a cage, right, and locked in a jail cell is the size of your bank account.
She says innocent until proven guilty should not have a price tag on it. I'm Jasmine Garst for Marketplace.
The Federal Reserve is, with maybe just a little bit of argument here, the most powerful single actor in this economy. And for most of the 107-something years it's been around, it has dealt mostly in the realm of financial markets and the banking system. That, though, is changing, and was changing even before the pandemic, and obviously before this past week. The Minneapolis Fed launched the Opportunity and Inclusive Growth Institute in 2017. It researches and does outreach on economic inequality, a systemic issue in this country that does seem especially relevant at this moment. Abigail Wozniak is the inaugural director of that institute. Dr. Wozniak, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So Chair Powell has been really vocal about inequality and what recessions and times like these do to people who don't have means in this society. That has not historically, though, been the case with the Fed, right? They have not really usually concentrated on inequality as a policy area. Do I have that right?
I think that's fair to say. I think that is the product of a number of things I could talk for a long time about. But I think as a summary, that's a fair thing to say.
So how now do you go about with your institute making monetary policy, right, interest rates, which is what the Fed is known for, fold that into inequality in this society and how raw an issue it is, as we've seen these past couple of days?
Right. So I want to be clear that today I'm not addressing current monetary policy and kind of per our blackout policies. But I think it's fair to ask, how does the Opportunity and Inclusive Growth Institute fit into the mandate of the Federal Reserve? I see our main projects at the Institute as really to bring new information into the Federal Reserve system and really grow the roots that we have in a much more diverse, much broader research community. The Fed has deep roots in research communities that I think wouldn't be a surprise to folks. What we don't have as strong a connection with is experts who understand how low-income families get by. I would say we have less connection to experts on exactly how work is restructured and evolving, and bringing those voices, just injecting all that knowledge into the Federal Reserve system, is something we work to do at the Institute.
You are there in the Twin Cities, the center of so much of, or the origin point of so much of what has been happening. If the Institute is successful and in, well, let's give it a decent run, right, 25 years, you've been able to really put your policies into practice. What does it look like on the ground?
So I think that on the ground, we will have, you know, I think a much stronger sense of the broader ramifications of Fed decisions. I think it would be great for me if it were routine to ask, what does the Opportunity and Inclusive Growth Institute think about this? If folks are routinely turning to the Institute and routinely turning to really our broader Federal Reserve research to say, what should we do with our cities? What should we do with wage policy? We are a resource for that, even though those are not the main pieces in our toolkit.
Just because you mentioned it, I want to make sure people understand. In periods leading up to meetings of the Federal Open Market Committee, the Federal Reserve is in what's known as a blackout, and there is typically no nobody from the Fed really does any interviews or makes speeches. You, though, decided to talk to us about this issue, and we appreciate that very much. I wonder why you didn't just say, sorry, blackout, as you could easily have done.
Well, a couple of reasons. I guess I could have said that. I will be clear, I didn't make the decision all by myself.
So
we've decided this as a team. But I think it's really, I'm almost sometimes in these days at a loss for words, so I'm sorry about that.
Yeah. We all are.
I think it's really important for folks, yeah, to understand that I would say, events have gotten quite ahead of the Institute, as they've gotten ahead of a lot of folks who are working to make kind of concrete policy change in these years. But I think the reason I said yes is I think it's important for folks to understand that this is immediately on the mind of the Federal Reserve, and we are taking real actions to pull in the information that we need to understand what folks are really experiencing on the ground. It's incredibly important when it's timely for the Federal Reserve to be very clear that we are working hard to absorb what is happening in the full sense of that word throughout the U.S. economy right now. And the Institute is a really important instrument for that. And I think other parts of the Federal Reserve are working hard at that as well. So that's why I said yes.
Abigail Wozniak, she is the director, the inaugural director, actually, of the Opportunity and Inclusive Growth Institute at the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis. Dr. Wozniak, thanks for your time. I really appreciate it.
All right. Thanks, Kai.
This final note on the way out today, it's going to be a quick one because we're a little bit tight on time. We know there is a public health crisis right now, and there is an economic crisis as well. But the Congressional Budget Office said today that that economic squeeze is going to last long after this lockdown is done. The CBO says the American economy is going to be almost $8 trillion smaller by the year 2030 than it would have been had nobody ever heard the word COVID-19. That's about a 3% hit from where we're supposed to be at the end of the decade. All right, we got to go. Here's your moment of economic context on the way out, planning calendar edition. This Friday is the first Friday of the month, which means we are going to get the May unemployment report. Spoiler alert, it is not gonna be great. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Andy Corbin, Ali Pham, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, Daisy Palacios, and Bennett Purser. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.